name is Neil Middleton, and every month we create informative content for you as we talk to important, influential, and inspirational people from the world of bats, as well as other areas of interest. To find out more about Batability, go to batability.co.uk. Now for the interview. Let's do it. Welcome, everybody. And wow, here we go again. Another Talking Bat with Batability. And to be fair, on this occasion, I think we're kind of underselling it a little bit to call it just a talking bat, because we're going to be talking a lot more than just bats today. I had the pleasure of meeting Miranda Collette, goodness, a couple of months ago now. And just by, I don't know, sheer chance, we were talking and we happened to ask Miranda a little bit about her history and what she got up to and et cetera, et cetera. And she started telling us a little bit about herself and what she did. And pretty much immediately, I thought, this is a story that a wider audience would be really, really interested in. So I am delighted to be joined today by Miranda Collette. How are you doing, Miranda?
Very well, thank you, Neil.
And where are you at the moment?
Well, I'm in a bat cage at the moment.
With very good internet.
So in actual fact, I'm in the island of Jersey and I'm looking out of my window and there's lots of red squirrels out there at my bird feeders, which I'm very
excited about. Wow. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about why I asked you that question in a few moments, because it's going to become pretty darn obvious that you do not spend all of your time in Jersey. Miranda describes herself as a freelance wildlife conservationist running a reserve in northeast Argentina. She divides her time between Jersey in the Channel Islands and Corrientes in Argentina.
Did correct, I say Corrientes. That correctly?
Excellent. Okay. And I also happen to know she's a keen wildlife photographer, because when we were in her company a few months ago, she was never far away from a camera. But yeah, Argentina, when are you next over there?
Leaving on the 12th of September for a 5-week trip, where I'll be spending some time at our farm in Buenos Aires and most of the time at the reserve up in Corrientes. And there's about 1,000 kilometres between the two places. So I have to get there by either overnight bus, which takes 12 hours, or by aeroplane, which takes an hour and a half. Depending on what I have to take with me, I decide on when I'm there.
Right. So the flight to Argentina, I take it that's London to Buenos Aires, yeah?
It is. It's London Heathrow to Buenos Aires. It's 14 and a half hours, including taxi time. It's a long flight. It's the longest flight VA do, actually. But so far... We usually get there more or less on time, perhaps with a day to spare. And British Airways do a fairly good job. I have to say that, though, because I used to work for them.
Yeah, I'm going to talk more about that in a minute, because as I think I said to you when we were speaking about this months ago, I am not a keen flyer. But as our audience are about to find out, yeah, I don't suspect you have got any issues flying whatsoever, but we'll talk about that in a moment. So you mentioned you've got a farm in Buenos Aires and the nature reserve is north of that. So have you got two separate bits of land? Is that how it works?
Yes, that's right. The farm in Buenos Aires we've owned for about 30 years now. My husband has a lot of relatives in Argentina. So we actually bought a farm next to some relatives and we've been running it. We're a grain farm. We grow wheat and soya and maize occasionally, and just running it more or less autonomously for the last 28 years, I guess, something like that. It just more or less covers itself. It doesn't make any money, of course, but it covers most of our costs, which is quite a help.
Okay. And then at some point, you end up purchasing, getting this bit of land further north, which you're running as a reserve. At what point did that come into the frame? And from a timeline point of view, how many years ago, many years ago did that happen?
Right, 2010. We bought the land up in Corrientes. It was a former cattle ranch, so it was totally undeveloped. There was no house on it whatsoever. So we had to completely start from scratch and build a house for our ranger, build a house for me, put some sheds up. But basically, we've left it untouched. It's there for the nature. It's there for the wildlife. And we just maintain the habitat as best we can, in spite of sometimes fires, sometimes flooding, sometimes invading cattle. but we try and look after the wildlife as best we can. For instance, during our fires, we were actually getting water from our borehole and transporting it down to the south to fill some of the water holes down there so the caiman could survive and the capybara as well. We do have our fair share of weather extremes there, I'm afraid. Far more so, really, during the last, 5 to 6 years.
What's the climate like compared to southern UK, the Channel Islands? Is it a similar climate, or is it hotter, wetter, colder? How would you compare it?
Yeah, it is completely different. It's very affected by the El Nino, La Nina effect phenomena. So we can get a whole year or even 2 years of flooding, and we have just had 4 years of drought. I think we're coming out of it fairly soon, but it's in general much hotter than Jersey. For instance, our temperature today in Jersey probably will reach 24, and we'll all be absolutely delighted. We'll think this is amazing. Over there, sometimes it touches, up in the reserve anyway, 40, which is actually not very comfortable, not very pleasant. We're on a solar system up there, so we don't have any supplied electricity. Although it is an excellent system, we can't have aircon, so we have to rely on fans. Okay. Most of the houses are wooden, so generally the same temperature in as out. So it can be quite uncomfortable in the warmer months, which are really anything from mid-spring until beginning of autumn.
Okay. Sounds fascinating. Look, we're going to talk a lot more about the reserve as this conversation goes on. But, you know, you grew up in Jersey, yeah? I think your parents were from Jersey, is that correct?
Correct.
And you attended school in Jersey.
Yes, I did.
And
school, but never mind.
Yeah, and immediately before or around about the time when you're managing this nature reserve, you were an airline pilot for British Airways on 747 jumbo jets. Yeah. So how does the school girl end up flying jumbo jets? There must be a bit of a story there. Tell us a little bit about that journey. Yeah.
I don't really know. One of my best friend's fathers was an airline pilot, and I might have been slightly influenced from that because none of my immediate family were pilots. But from the age of 17, I decided that's what I definitely wanted to be. And I think partly one of the influences of my school, and I said, they asked us all what careers we wanted, teacher, secretary, and things like that.
But that would have been fairly typical of the time.
Absolutely, yeah. And they said, no, you can't fly aeroplanes. It's only men that can do that. So from then on, I was absolutely determined that that's what I was going to do. I mean, I didn't really expect I would be an airline pilot, but yes, I had some flying lessons really in my late teens, early 20s, and I just totally hooked after the third lesson. I absolutely adored it and then decided it was going to be my career, definitely. So I did it by flight instructing at Biggin Hill, building up my hours. I think initially I went to the United States to get the licenses there. It's an awful lot cheaper to fly there. I think I had to fly about 500 hours or something. It was ridiculous, just to build some hours up. Then after I flight instructed, I came back, that was in England, I came back to Jersey and did my instrument rating with a company called Eric L'Antique, which had an air taxi company and some fairly historic aeroplanes, actually, which they used for freight. Anyway, I did my instrument rating with this company, which is quite an important part of the license. This is how you fly an aeroplane without looking out. You just do it by instrumentation. And as I passed first time, which was pretty amazing, a bit fluke, I think, they actually offered me a job as an air taxi pilot. And my husband happened to be the owner of that company. I mean, he wasn't my husband at the time, of course. He was someone I admired very much. But so we got together a few years after that. And I worked for him for 4 years. And then I started joining the airlines when I got my airline pilot, airline transport pilot's license. I joined British Air Ferries on the Viscounts.
I remember them, Viscounts,
Lovely big windows for the passengers. And then they put me on the Shorts 360, 330.
Oh, that's like a sky van.
It's a horrible aeroplane. I loathe
it. It's a box.
Yes, it's an isocretion box prone to bird strikes from the rear.
From the rear?
From the rear. It goes so slowly, yes. Okay. Well, I wasn't happy after the Viscount. That was a definite climb, descent for me. So I then joined British Caledonian and went on the BAC 111, which was the noisiest aeroplane you could ever imagine. And then British Airways took us over a year later. And we slotted into the seniority, so I did quite well. I ended up being quite senior after that, which was very lucky for me, because seniority counts for quite a lot in British Airways. You can get to choose your trips.
Okay, right.
So after that, after about a year with BA on the 111, I then switched to the 747 and did all my training on that.
That's a big switch.
Yes.
Because the 111 isn't, it's not a big jet. Maybe like 100 passengers, I think, on a 111, something like that.
Might have been 120, but...
Okay. A 747, that's as big as you get. You don't get a bigger... Well, at that time, you wouldn't have got a bigger passenger.
At that time. No, you're right. At that time, nothing bigger than that. So anyway, I made the transition, thoroughly enjoyed it, found the places I liked. Buenos Aires. Of course, we already had the farm then, so that was great. I would just... go to the hotel, someone would deliver my car for me, and I'd drive out to my farm, which was about a two-hour drive from the crew hotel, and then come back for the flight home. So that worked out quite well. No, I thoroughly enjoyed being on the 747. I got my command after about, I suppose, 14 years of being in BA, which at the time was very fast, nothing to do with any merit. It's just purely seniority. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. So I got my command on the 747, and then I really started enjoying it. When you're in control of an aeroplane like that, you make all the decisions. It is quite nice.
Okay. Can I ask, and I don't want this to be an awkward question, okay, but when you were flying the 747s for the first time, I'm imagining there wouldn't have been a lot of female pilots around at that point in time. Is that correct, or am I misinformed there?
I believe I was about the fifth to go on the 747, and most of them were from British Caledonian, actually. So, yes, I wasn't by any means the first.
But whereas, thankfully and rightfully, these days, it's just not uncommon at all to... So you totally, I suppose I'm taking you back to the careers advice at school when you're told only men can fly planes and all this kind of stuff. You're kind of okay at the first, but you're kind of one of the earlier people in that organization to be doing something like that.
No, it's good fun. It's a great job, and I'd recommend it to anyone, really.
Yeah.
It's not quite as good as it was. I think I was there during the best times, but
well. If you're enjoying listening to our podcasts, perhaps you would also be interested in joining Batability Club. To find out more about Club, which includes hundreds of hours of accessible training resources available to you in your own time and at your own pace, go to batability.co.uk. Thank you. I've Where does your interest in nature come from? So, because that's where you are now. Were you interested in the natural world as a child, a teenager, that developed later? Where did that come from?
Well, I think I've always preferred animals to humans. Not a very nice thing to say, I suppose, but it's probably true.
Do you want me to hang up now then?
My father was a very keen ornithologist, and he studied the puffins and the barn owls in Jersey. So I was obviously influenced from him. But I really got into wildlife conservation after doing a course with Doral Wildlife Academy. And it was absolutely wonderful. I learned so much during that course. It's a 3-week course and full of people from around the world. I think there were just two of us from Jersey and one from England. Everyone else was from other parts of the world. It was amazing. I learned so much. And after that course, I decided that I had a bit of money from British Airways. I was able to move my pension from British Airways to Jersey, and I was given a 30%, I think, tax-free lump sum, so I could buy some land in Argentina, and which is what I did. And well, anyway, it's been pretty successful. I've absolutely loved my life since I left BA, but I did enjoy my time with BA. But after 21 years, I definitely wanted to do something else. It was quite unusual to leave BA so early. Most people stay until they retire, but I just wanted to do something with animals, and I wanted a change, I suppose. And I knew the countries I liked at that stage, and mostly it was Argentina or South America in general, actually. I love most of South America.
Yeah.
So,
carry on.
So I made the switch anyway, and I'm very happy, but much poorer now than I was, of course.
Yeah, of course. But you can measure wealth in different ways. Yeah. But what was the last flight you did with British Airways then, as a captain or man, as you call it?
Funnily enough, I hardly had any photos taken of me when I was with BA, but my last flight, I insisted, and I put my hat on and everything, and my jacket, and this is the one here that you have showing on the screen.
Okay.
It was to Bangalore, which was a place I'd never been to before. It was a new route for BA. It's quite a high airfield. I remember I did a bit of a bumpy touchdown, so it wasn't like my last flight. And I gave the sector away to my first officer on the way back, which is quite normal. If there's two of you, you give one of the sectors away. Actually, there were three of us, but the other guy didn't get a sector.
Okay.
And yeah, we just had, I think, 24 hours in Bangalore. It might have been 36, I can't remember now. And then back again, and then that was it. No more.
Right.
Uniform back.
So getting off that plane when you've come back to London, yeah. There must have been some emotion there. There must have been some uncertainty. There must have been an element of, am I doing the right thing or not? I mean, talk me through that.
I knew I would miss it in some ways. Yes, very emotional, of course. But no, I decided I wanted a change in career, and that was it. I've had absolutely no regrets since I left. I believe things were not quite so good after I left. There was a lot of problems, flight crew versus cabin crew. There were arguments, and I'm not quite sure why, unions involved. And I think, quite honestly, I had the best days. I was quite pleased to be out of it. But when I travelled to Buenos Aires, we also go to North Florida quite a lot. Quite often I used to know the captains, and they'd come and chat to me, which was very nice. Obviously, you can't go up to the flight deck nowadays. Nobody can.
That's right. Yeah.
One of the crew. Yeah. But they can come out and see me, which was lovely. So I kept in touch for a while. But I think probably by now most of my colleagues have left. The younger ones certainly will still be there. But my era will probably mostly have left by now, I suspect.
Okay. Right. So let's start talking about Collect Trust for Endangered Species. Yeah. There's the website www.collecttrust.org. So that's collett-trust.org. collect-trust.org. What was the vision here? So you're already acquainted with Argentina. You're already bought into Argentina because you've got the farm just outside Buenos Aires. You didn't have to buy a piece of land in Argentina. You didn't have to do anything. What was the vision? Where did, what was the thought process? Was it
Okay.
save the planet or was it save a particular species? Where was it?
I suppose to help wildlife, basically, learn more about it, make a bit of a difference, perhaps try and educate the Argentines a little bit more about wildlife, and to see all these amazing animals that there are up there, and indeed in the rest of South America. To be fair, initially I looked at an island because when we did the course at Durrell, we did concentrate on island biology quite a lot. So I did look around for an island, but I realised that my money would only buy a very tiny island and it would be extremely difficult to get to. I could buy a helicopter, which obviously I couldn't afford, or by sailing. I actually did a day skipper's course because I thought, well, I might have to get a yacht and start sailing here. Thank goodness I saw some sense and decided an island was just not worth it. Get a bit of land, and I ended up buying this land. Looked around for about a year, I guess, and then found this beautiful land, wetland in the Esteros de Libera in Corrientes, which is a vast wetland, the second biggest in the Americas. And it's full of really nice birds, especially. I mean, reptiles, mammals, bats, of course, but birds is probably the main thing. They are really stunning. And initially, I really wanted to do a reintroduction program, which we now call rewilding, and introduce a crassid into the reserve. In fact, I spent an awful lot of money building aviaries for this bird, getting all the radio tracking equipment, only to find that bureaucracy in Argentina is so difficult to get around, even though two of my trustees are Argentine. We just had stumbling blocks put in front of us all the time. Eventually, we got a male crassid, barefaced curassow, they are called in English. And but he was very elderly, and I don't really think he was a suitable breeding age. But he was with us for about 3 or 4 years, and then he basically died of old age, poor chap. But we did give him a very good home, and I think we made his life very nice. He was rescued from a reserve where his cage had basically blown away due to terrible thunderstorms. We never managed to get a female, and I'm afraid I have abandoned that project. I don't like abandoning projects, but it was one which was never going to be. We just, perhaps because I was a foreigner, I honestly don't know, but nothing happened there. So in 2014, after I'd done a bat course in the UK, I was able to get permits for bat work at my reserve, and I started doing it initially. Well, back in 2012, recording and finding out what we had there. But of course, there's no bat call library in Argentina, so I was a bit limited what I could do. And then I started capture release sessions and found out a little bit more. Again, I didn't, there were no good photographs of some of these bats, so I really didn't have any idea what I was catching, but I learned. There were some books that had been written in Argentina, so I learned. I got a few wrong, I have to say. we found eventually 15 species in the reserve, and definitely one, Promops centralis, that is there. We get him on acoustic recording all the time, very distinctive, but a very high flyer bat, which you can't catch. So we have definitely got 16 species at the reserve, and it's not bad. It's only 4,000 acres. I mean, that does sound quite big, but I think for that size, more or less all our land is grassland with the odd forest patch and wetland. So it's pretty much the same. I think that's quite good to have that many species on our land. I'm quite pleased with that. But I'm still working away at a bat call library for Argentina. It's just taking time, as all these things do.
Absolutely. But that's fascinating. So the trust as it is today then, I know you've got staff, you've got other trustees, you've got people that are there, I think, permanently all the time. You have people visiting to help with research and voluntary work. Am I correct in all of that? Is that how it's kind of developed?
Yes, we just have one employee, couldn't afford another. The two trustees that my Argentine trustees actually live on site now. They've built their own house and it is a much nicer house than mine. It's not wood. It's made of brick. So it's much more thermal and much more comfortable to live in. So they do most of the work there when I'm not there, in fact. But we do have volunteers and we do encourage volunteers. I've taught quite a few people initially how to work with bats, how to handle bats. I haven't done any of that really since COVID because we haven't had many volunteers since COVID, but I'm still hoping we will get some more. But I have a bat team, which is absolutely great. And usually we can get together at, I have to give them a bit of notice, and go up to the next province, Misiones, which is really a part of Brazil. It's a little peninsula that extends into Brazil with Paraguay on the west side. And the bats there, well, for me, are slightly more interesting, perhaps. There are many Phyllostomidae up there. And thing with bat research in Argentina is there's not an awful lot known about it. So you can make discoveries. And there's so many things that we're puzzling about. There's just so much to learn. I just find it absolutely fascinating. And if anyone wants to volunteer to come and do some bat work with us, that's always very gratefully accepted, especially acoustic recorders. We could really do with someone to help me with the bat call library.
Sounds fascinating. And at the end of this discussion, we'll have Miranda's email address if anybody wants to get in touch in that respect. So where do things go with this? Because you've been there quite a bit of time now. You've kind of got systems and processes in place. I would imagine there's not that many surprises now regarding what you own in terms of land and the challenges that come along with that. How do you see things? You know, what is the vision? You know, where do you see this 5 years from now, 15 years from now? Is there a vision?
Well, we have had to put two lodges in to encourage birding tourism. And we do get quite a lot of birders that come, and they all love the reserve because it's so easy to see our bird species. We have quite a few endangered species. It's easy to take photographs of our birds because it's mainly grassland. And strangely enough, they're really quite tame. Well, not tame exactly, but they're not nearly as nervous and timid as birds in woodlands that I've been to are. So people do love coming to the Esteros de Libera. They really do. It's not just our place. There's many other places they could go to, but we are the only ones up in the north. And in general, except for the drought, we are normally wetter than the other areas. And we have these endangered birds that we can guarantee that you will see. If perhaps a couple of months you might not, but mostly you will see these birds. That they are endangered, we do need to know more about them. So we are always encouraging bird ringers, anyone like that, to come along and perhaps do some projects with us. In fact, we do have a bird ringer coming out in August, next August, to do some bird ringing. And we hope to sort of continue these programs as much as we can. And meanwhile, the bat programs are continuing, of course. Like, well, we won't be doing anything to stop that. We're planning a bat conference in our local town, which is about an hour and a half away. We're down a dirt road, 32 kilometers, with 8 gates to open. So it's not quickly up and down it. But the bat conference, I mean, it's going to be fairly low key. I don't know how many people will actually want to attend, because the Argentines consider bats as vampires, all vampires, vampiros, they always go. To try and educate them that not all bats are vampires. And in fact, vampire bats are lovely. I love handling the Desmodus rotundus. We have a lot at our reserve because we have a lot of cattle ranches around us. And that's what they feed on, the cattle, and occasionally our horses as well. also in the area is Daimus Jungii, which is another vampire bat, but a much rarer one, which we're doing some research into. We've managed to just capture it once in Misiones. But we have to educate the general public that they mustn't kill their bats, because I don't believe they are really protected in Argentina yet. It's getting better. We do find when we talk to people, they do change their mind a little bit. There's an awful lot of them that are terrified of bats. Well, I guess that's probably true worldwide, isn't it? Less so in Britain and Jersey, because we're beginning to appreciate our bats as there's less and less of them every year. So we do an education programme. And in fact, these tourists that come on birding trips, if I'm there, I will do a bat, some echolocation for them in the evening to sort of show, not show them our bats as such, but show them what they sound like.
Yes.
That's always really popular. So I'm just trying to try and think what else we do, really. We just maintain the habitat. We have actually rescued rehabilitated a couple of mammals, the southern tamandua. We've done that twice now. One took about a good month to rehabilitate, and the other was a bit quicker. There isn't a picture of it here, actually. It's the most beautiful. It's like a small giant anteater. Yeah.
Beautiful. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
Really stunning little thing there. But they're arboreal, whereas the giant anteater, which I have worked with in the past as a volunteer, tend to be, they're terrestrial.
Okay.
This poor thing had got caught in a trap. It was brought to us and it had maggots in its wound, and we had to really look after this poor little thing. And we learnt, as I've worked with giant anteaters, how to feed it, which is, I won't go into all the detail, but it's very different from feeding anything else, believe me. Tongue is about 60 centimetres.
Okay, right.
Let's say 40, perhaps that's exaggerating a bit. Gigantic tongue. And so we have to put the food in a bottle where only the anteater can actually get it, and no other creatures like our foxes, who are desperate to get at it, can actually get a look in. So that's another thing we do. I'm sure there's other things we do, but I can't sort of think of anything right at the moment.
So it's just continuing to protect the land and find out as much as possible about things like the bats that are there, and hearts and minds, trying to just change public opinion about conservation, bats in particular, but other aspects of conservation as well, I would imagine. Yeah.
Absolutely, yes. Also, we put up bat boxes, and they seem to be occupied very quickly. We built a beautiful bat condo, which was adapted from a Wisconsin design. Unfortunately, we've only ever had about two or three bats in that, which is a bit disappointing, because it is a beautiful building. It really is. But for some reason, they don't like it. I don't know why. Maybe we've built the slats too wide apart. Like, you know, they do need to be quite close together for the smaller bats anyway, which are the ones that obviously will go in a bat house, the crevice dwellers. But we're still putting up more bat boxes, and we have spoken to other wildlife reserves in both Corrientes and Misiones, and given them advice where to put bat boxes and how to do it. And of course, we do acoustic surveys as well, and look for roosts. That's another thing. We do a little bit of radio tracking, but so far we've never had enough time to actually find a roost. We've released the bat with the radio tag on successfully and tracked it that night a little bit. But the next day when we try to look for the roost, we've not been able to find it. And usually then we have to move on somewhere else. So we just haven't had enough time so far to do any successful radio tracking. And I think you do need time. You need at least a week.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. And as you may know, I've done quite a bit of radio tracking bats over the years. And it's hard. Well, look, you know, I'm talking about Scotland, who have got relatively accessible places and relatively safe places, and we don't have to worry about the kind of things that you might have to worry about. And it can be darn difficult. You can spend hours, if not days, trying to locate a roost. And I've got many stories I can tell of bats that were assumed to be dead, you know, or totally gone. And then you go out for just one more day and then bang, you find it. And you would have given up days earlier had you not been so resilient and stuff like this. So I would imagine where you are, you would have issues with terrain and stuff like this as well, wouldn't you? You know,
yes, especially in Misiones, where we're talking about thousands and thousands of kilometres of forest, really, jungle. It's very difficult. You can only stick to paths. You can't really go in the forested areas. Whereas our reserve is easy because the small patches we have of woodland, there's probably only about 6 or 7 of them, and they are reasonably accessible. We did tag a Pachyderma bilabiatum, myself and Molly Watson, who's a good friend of mine that I trained initially, but she's actually doing quite a lot of work in Newcastle at the moment. And we managed to catch this bat, which was very unexpected. It had only been found in Corrientes once before. So we decided to put a radio tag on. We tracked it that night without problems. And then we just rode around on horses the next day and the next day. We just didn't get any signal from it at all. And the only thing we can assume is that it is rare, very rare in our area. It was passing through, it's migrating through most likely. And it was probably miles away at that stage with this radio tag on, poor thing. Nobody being able to pick up the signal. It was a bit of a shame, really. And then after that, I think Molly had to go back to her parents' farm in Cordoba and I had to go back to Buenos Aires. So that was it. We persevere, but we do need more time to do these things. I think I was high in the sky, really, thinking that we could do a cat, definitely find the roost the next day. And some of the terrain we try in Misiones.
Yeah, I think that depends on the bat, depends on the terrain. There's so many different variables that can make it harder, I suppose. Definitely there are so many variables that can make it harder. Let's just go back a little bit. So you're talking about these people that come on wildlife watching tours or bird watching tours. So I take it they pay to be there, yes? Yeah, okay.
They do now, Neil. They used not to, but I'm afraid we've got to the stage where we need funding and funding is very difficult to get.
Yeah. Okay. And if they're paying to be there, they're not getting treated as volunteers. They're there as your guests, and I'm assuming one of the trustees or your ranger is then maybe doing some guided tours with them. Is this correct?
That is correct. Alejandra, my deputy and one of my trustees, has a tour guide company. She's also chairman of tourism in the province of Corrientes. And she is the one that gets the guests. I'm an NPO, Collet Trust is an NPO, so we can't accept money. We can only accept donations. So she actually employs people to come when they have guests there and do the guides. They do about 3 excursions each day, including a night excursion. And it's very, very popular. And the lodges are beautiful. They've been stunningly designed, all done during COVID when I couldn't get there. So I can't claim any of that, I'm afraid. That's really all down to Alejandra and her partner, Seppi. They have done an amazing job with those lodges. But we're very, very grateful for the donations we get to the trust, which help a little bit towards the running costs. But basically, it's me putting in most of the money still. When we had the fires last year, we had some very generous donations, and I'm eternally grateful to those people. But at the moment, we're still having to replace lots of fencing where cattle have broken through from neighbouring farms. We do normally share the cost with the farmer, in theory anyway, but we're the ones that really need it. They don't. They're quite happy for their cattle to be in our land. As you can imagine, we have beautiful grass, not grazed. So it's not quite as important to them as it is to us to keep their cattle out.
Okay. I think it's mostly from the Americas people go on these birding trips, or do you have people coming over from Europe or Asia, Australasia?
At the moment, mainly Canadians, North Americans, United States, Argentines, obviously the wealthier ones, because it's not particularly cheap when they're there. They get all their meals, four meals a day, and they get the excursions all thrown in. So it's quite a pricey deal, but it's good value for us. It would seem very cheap. We are trying to get more Europeans, but they're reticent to go back to South America, it seems, after COVID. It will happen for sure. Maybe next year, perhaps we'll get a few more. But prior to COVID, we were getting Chinese coming, not to stay in the lodges, but just to come for the day and see our birds. So we're hoping Chinese will start coming back again. That would be very nice.
Okay. So as part of this interview, as people will know, Bat Ability quite often makes a donation in the name of the person that we're interviewing to a charity or a worthy cause. And I'm delighted to say that as a thank you to Miranda, we're going to make a small donation to collecttrust.org. Okay, they have a donations page on their website, so it's the same website address I gave you earlier, but it's /help-the-trust, so help the trust with the hyphens in the appropriate place. So we're going to be making a small donation to Collect Trust for Endangered Species after we've done this interview with Miranda. Miranda, you've talked a lot about the donations, etc. I would imagine that anybody that wants to make any sort of donation, no matter how small, would be gratefully received. Yes.
Oh, that would be absolutely amazing. But I'm not expecting that. Goodness me. Thank you very much for your donation. The money in Argentina goes a long way. Inflation with the Argentine peso is 100% a year at the moment. It is dire.
Wow.
When I first started going there, well, probably 30 years ago, it was $1 to, 1 peso to the dollar. I think yesterday it was 750 pesos to the dollar. It's changed so much since I was last there, which was only in April. So it's really bad. Dollars and pounds go up real long way. And there is a blue rate over there, which everybody uses, so I don't see why I shouldn't say, but it's quite different from the official bank rate, and we all change our money on the blue market. You get a lot more pesos, so any donation is very gratefully accepted.
Right. Well, we're delighted to be contributing, albeit in a small way, but we're delighted to be contributing. And I'm really fascinated about this, and I don't know if we'll ever get there. But it certainly sounds like the kind of place that I would want to go to. I mean, the sheer diversity of reptiles, amphibians, mammals, not just bats, but all the other mammals. You've got the bird species. How many bird species do you have there?
I think our list is 320, something like that at the moment. It's going up all the time. We discover new species every year. Less than we did the first years, of course.
Yeah.
We actually have a species that was found at our reserve, gosh, in 2010, and a new species was described. It's a small seed eater. It's quite an attractive little bird, and it's always around our reserve, so we're quite happy to have it, actually. It's called the Ibirá seed eater.
In terms of mammals, excluding the bats, what would be your, I don't like the term big five or flagship, but somebody coming there interested in mammals, what would be the things they'd be most excited by with seeing?
Well, I don't know about most excited by, most bombarded by would be our capybaras. We have so many of them, and they breed like rabbits. They're the biggest rodent in the world. They are really rather cute. Honestly, you can get within a meter of them and they won't even move now. So they're always in our garden. We have to protect all our shrubs and our trees from them, but we're still very happy to have them. They're not endangered in any way at all. The two endangered mammals that we have are the maned wolf.
Okay.
which is beautiful. It's actually a fox with very long legs and a sort of mane. But it is a beautiful animal and we very rarely see it. I've seen one close up once when I was horse riding. We heard it barking. It does bark. And we actually were so lucky to find it lying in the grass. And it saw us, probably never seen a human before. I sort of just got up and sauntered away. But generally, they are so shy, they will steer away from humans. But they are beautiful animals. And the other endangered species we have is the marsh deer. They are beautiful deer. They're quite heavy. They're quite big. Sort of 150 kilos a male can reach. And we haven't had so many during the drought, but when it's wet, we do get a lot of them. And they do breed one fawn a year normally, the females. So yes, that's another endangered species. At the moment, we don't have any giant anteaters because we were too wet, and we will be again. I think we are a wetland. They prefer slightly drier areas where the termites build their mounds. And in the area has been rewilded jaguars. So there are jaguars not too far from us. I don't know, probably about 50 kilometers away. So you never know, we could get jaguars sometime. We have seen ocelots on our radio cameras, our camera traps, not our radio cameras. I forgot to mention, there is a reintroduction program which is actually moving onto our reserve. It was at the national park, which is not far from us, but they were getting so many hunters there. And there's always people on our reserve, so it's much more protected. So these guys have actually brought their cage and their equipment to our reserve, and they will be continuing the project there to rewild. It's called a guacamayo rojo. It's a macaw, green-winged macaw, or green and red macaw, I think we call it in red and blue macaw, something like that in Britain. It is a beautiful macaw, and boy, does it make a noise. You can hear them coming. But they like our land. They often visited us when they were based at the national park. And they have radio tracking equipment on them. I think it's around their necks they have something. But anyway, we're delighted to actually offer some accommodation, a whole woodland, to the project. And we hope it will be successful. There's lots of breeding boxes put up at our reserve with them in the woodlands. So far, they've been occupied by barn owls, which we're delighted as well, because we didn't see barn owls until about 5 years ago. But we do hope the macaws will take up residence and breed there eventually.
Wow. Okay. That all sounds really exciting. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you want to mention? I always worry at this stage that we're going to stop an interview and I've missed or you've missed something really obvious that should have been spoken about. Is there anything that comes to mind?
Not really, Neil. I think probably we've covered most things.
Yeah. And it's been absolutely fascinating. And obviously I knew a bit of the backstory before we started today, but there's a few more gaps in my knowledge being filled in there. And I'm certain that anybody listening to this will be really interested in what you're doing, inspired by what you've done, and keen to see how things develop going forward, etc. So you're back there in a couple of weeks, for 5 weeks. Typically, how often do you go across? Do you go, what, 2-3 times a year?
Yeah, before COVID, I went 6 times a year. But to be honest, the flights have got more expensive. I can really only afford to go 3 times a year now, but I tend to go for longer. So I go a minimum of probably 5 weeks at a time. So that's 3 times a year. It's not enough. I know it's not enough. I avoid the summer months because it's so hot, but I tend to go in the shoulder months, the autumn and the spring, when it is really lovely, actually. But I may go this next year in August when we have the bird ringer from Alderney coming to see us. Some work. Yeah. I would like to get involved with bird ringing again. I used to do it. I haven't done it for years. So that would be good. Anyway, sounds Neil, brilliant. You are very welcome to come, of course, whenever you like. And Aaron as well.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. And if we ever did come, we'd be paying, okay, to be there. We'd be doing waiting or something. I don't know, all right? But
certainly wouldn't be paying.
Yeah. But Aaron was with me when we had the conversation with Miranda a couple of months ago, and he's been chewing my ears ever since about, we've got to go to Argentina, we've got to go to Argentina, which is kind of translated as, hey, will you pay for me to come to Argentina with you? That's what he's wangling at. But There is no way I would be able to go there without him coming along as well. So
that would be lovely.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay, so there you have it, folks. Miranda Collette of the Collette Trust for Endangered Species. A fascinating interview. I've loved it. I've found out so much more now than what I knew before. And I hope you've all found out quite a bit about Miranda and what she gets up to and her past, her backstory and all the likes. If you're in the British Isles, you may very well come across Miranda on the island of Jersey. She does bat work with the local bat group, for example, down there. So if you do come across her at any point, I know she would be delighted for you to say hello. And reminder that you maybe first came across her on a Talking Bat interview, if that indeed was the case. Okay, take a breath, Neil. What I'm going to do now, as we normally do at the end of these interviews, is I'm going to shut up and I'm going to ask my guest just to say thank you and goodbye to our audience. So over to you, Miranda, if you could say thank you and goodbye to our audience, we'll end the interview there. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Neil, and thank you for anyone that's listening. And we'd love to see more people at our reserve, especially bat workers. They're always very welcome. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Talking Bat interview, which is an edited audio-only version of the original video session. The full version, including video, is available via Bitability Club, our online training platform. To find out more about Club, go to bitability.co.uk. Till next time, thank you.